Welcome to the Diabetes Chat. Tonight we have Paul O'Neill, our guest speaker. Paul is a former British Touring Car Championship driver and now is an ITV sports pundit. Paul found his passion for motorsports from a very young age and had an impressive 15-year career in the hot seat and achieved notable successes along the way, including his famous first BTCC win on his home circuit in 2002, and that must have been a really a proud achievement, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, tonight. In 2004, Paul was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and was forced to rebuild his career over the upcoming years, returning back to the track in 2006, achieving an impressive 3 top 10s in his 6 remaining races. Paul's next full season in the BTCC would come in 2009 and retiring in 2013, I believe. Paul is the co-founder of 29 Productions and does mentoring, coaching. And tonight we welcome Paul to the Diabetes Chat, and we'll be talking about some of his career highlights and, of course, diabetes stories. So welcome, Mr. Paul O'Neill.
That was very nice. Thanks very much. You know, and all that stuff you mentioned there, I forgot about half of it. So thanks for reminding me.
Absolutely. Reliving the past memories, right? Exactly. Hopefully some of them good.
Yeah, no, it's great. No, it's lovely to thanks for having us on, and it's lovely to think about when you mention stuff like that about, you know, getting diagnosed in 2004 and then having to, you know, when you mentioned rebuilding your career, it's something I completely forgot I had to do, because you know, you're kind of so focused in sport in general, professional sport, to just try to win, you know, and do your best. But thinking about it now, I've retired and you've mentioned it, you do think, well, actually, that was not a bad achievement to just get back in the seat and
of course
get back racing. But yeah, no, happy memories. And just always the point to get across for me is always, you know, it's a very fortunate, you know, place to be, to make a living and be able to use your passion to race. But with diabetes, you know, getting involved, it was something that could have been a bigger problem than it actually was. So
bigger problem than it was. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and over the course of the hour, we'll talk about that. So what we've got, mate, is a few sections. Mm-hmm. A first section, we're going to just do sort of quick fire round questions, just to get to know you a little bit more on your diabetes. Mm-hmm. Then I'm going to lead us in a section talking about when you were diagnosed and your journey with diabetes. Yeah. And then Gary is going to host the main sort of topic of the night, talking about your career of pre-diabetes, and then also when you got diagnosed and how it sort of affected your life going forward, really, in your line of work as in that industry. Mm-hmm. And then we'll talk about the sort of roles that you're doing now as a sports pundit and other sort of career roles that I mentioned in the intro. Mm. And then we'll round up with some mental health and some peer support questions. So lots to get through, guys. If you want to get involved, hashtag diabetes chat. You can also request a mic and you can come speak to Paul, and I'm sure he'll welcome any questions rather than just me and Gary asking all the questions. So let's crack on, because we've got lots to get through, and keep us updated, Paul, with the Liverpool score, right? Okay.
Oh, of course. Of course. So,
what is your name and occupation?
So my name is Paul O'Neill, and I suppose I am an ITV sport pundit and commentator.
When were you diagnosed with diabetes, and how old were you?
January 2004, and I was 24 years of age.
Do you finger prick or use smart technology?
Smart technology.
Oh, how cool, right?
It's amazing.
So when you did finger prick back in the day, oof, did you change your lancets every day?
You broke up then. No. Did I? Who does?
Absolutely. Do you use insulin pens or are you on a pump?
I am an insulin pen user.
Ooh. Are you hypo aware?
Yes, very.
What symptoms do you have typically, Paul?
Just a feeling of confusion, and if I get a bad one, I will sweat a lot.
Yeah. What's your go-to hypo treatment?
There's two things. So mix a can of Coke, like a little one, or like I've got next to my bed now, just a dextro gel.
Norman, be impressed. What do you think is worse for you, feeling hypo or feeling hyper?
Ugh, hypo.
Why?
Oh, just the horrible confusion it causes me. Hyper is just, I just know it can come down and it'll go away, but you try getting Mo Salah's just scored, it's 1-0.
Yes, buddy!
Yes, get in! Sorry.
Happy days! Come on, describe the goal. Oh, we're doing a live call here, Paul.
Everton hit the post off a corner and then we broke, and I think it was Gakpo, maybe, squared it to Mo Salah and we scored. So all you football fans out there, that, and my next door neighbour had just texted me about 30 seconds ago, so I must be lagging. He just said we'd scored. Brilliant. So there you
brilliant.
Go. Yeah.
Gappo's actually done something right for the first time. Exactly, anyway, that's another talk. Okay. What one thing you like about diabetes and one thing you don't like about diabetes?
One thing I like about it is I think it really helped me to get back in my motorsport career, just because I had to I was fitter than I ever had been in racing when I come back, because I knew I couldn't afford to have it taken away from me again.
Do you think if you had been diagnosed now, in your sort of role like you are as a sports pundit, do you think it would have been a different sort of
definitely
relationship you would have had with your diabetes? Because you were not saying that you're resilient now and motivated for your current job, but I guess you had so much, like, you wanted to fight every blood, sweat and tear to get back into the motoring race, career, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think you've just hit the nail on the head, to be fair. It was all to do with being focused. It was, you know, I knew what it was like to have it taken off me. I didn't want to lose it again. But I think, I'm not saying I've got nothing to lose now, but, you know, if I'd have been diagnosed now, I think I'd have not been as precise and as focused on making sure I was the best me, diabetic.
Yeah, you know
what I mean. Yeah.
No, I totally get it. I totally get it.
Yeah.
Do you love or hate the smell of insulin?
I actually don't mind it. I don't mind it at all. I'll tell you what's weird though. I've had a few girlfriends with being a racing driver. I've had a few girlfriends, and they absolutely have loved the smell of it. So.
Wow!
Yeah, if you've got a partner that likes the smell of hospitals, then give them a whiff of it.
Oh, Gary and Norman on the panel so far. I think tonight's chat's just going to be funny. It's going to be great. Loving it. Yeah,
Paul, I do want to ask you quickly.
Yeah.
Are there any particular rules for diabetics in racing? Because obviously, with actual driving on roads, there's rules, you know, you have to be a certain level and all that. Is that the same kind of thing in racing?
No, you're stealing my thunder.
There is. It stuffed me. It ruined, I thought, my career, but it didn't. So there was like a 6-month red tape. So I basically lost a season, which turned into losing 2 seasons, because when I got my license back, nobody wanted to know. I'd kind of like, at the top level in British motorsport, which British touring cars is, you're forgotten about. And I had to convince manufacturers to give me another chance and sponsors, which I did. But yeah, the MSA, which is, or it was called the MSA, the Motorsport Association in the UK, they, as soon as you're diabetic, you have to just give your license back, and then you're put on like a kind of a probation thing where the doctor at the Medical Council of Motorsport for UK has to review every case one by one. So that's why I was so focused. You have to go with your HP.
Does that like change when you, I don't know, do you go to other countries? Or I don't know much about racing. As far as I see it, it's cargo, vroom, vroom, and it's exciting. So
yeah, no. I mean, it's a good question, because You basically, yes, you get, so it's like, if you know, if you go and drive in America on your UK license, it's exactly the same as that. Nobody, it just says on the back of my license, and any other diabetic in the UK, as I know, it says valid by medical visa. It's basically saying you have passed you've got a medical exemption. Your doctor has said you're fit to race and your HbA1c is fine. You're not blind and you've got feet and stuff like that. That's the kind of stuff it's just passing. So yeah, once you're kind of ticked off by the UK or any country where you've got your race license from, you're okay to go abroad. That's if you've got an international license, which I've got. So yeah, but it's a good question. Yeah, difficult one. It was difficult, but there's a
nice to know. Glad you're willing to share.
The what? Sorry.
I said nice to know. Glad you're willing to share.
Yeah. Oh, listen, I'm an open book. You ask me anything you want, as long as it's nothing about the Tories or anything like that.
No. And we keep it clean on here, guys. No swearing. Otherwise, I'll have to edit a podcast worth 3.5 hours. And I don't want to be sat here till 4 a.m. editing podcasts. So keep it nice.
I wouldn't have said that, mate, if you know me.
And to be fair, mate, when Liverpool scored, surprised you didn't like jump through the roof or something.
I was going to say, I expected more screaming from you there, Tom, as well.
I'm controlled. I'm in the zone. Okay, Paul, if you, right, are on a desert island, you're on a diabetes chart desert island, and we send all our guest speakers here. So you've got like people like Mandy Marquardt, who's a cyclist. We've got Jack Idale, who was there last week. You've got Parthakar, HCP. You've got all these amazing people on our diabetes chat island. Mm-hmm. What three things would you take to the island? And you know what? I'm going to be nice. I'm going to give you all your diabetes kit so you don't have to worry. It's like on tap. It's there for you 24/7. What three things would you take with you?
Wow. Oh, my God. That's a terrible thing to ask. I would take my...
Please say it, racing car.
Yeah. I'm not that boring. I would take my iPad. I would take also... Oh, God. I'd have to take... What? I'd have to... If I could, and there was a way of getting it there, I'd have to take my my exercise bike, which is like a Wahoo kicker thing, like a turbo trainer, because I like doing that kind of stuff. And... what else would I take? I'd take a cap because I'm going quite bald and it's like starting to burn my head anywhere I go now where it's hot.
There we go. And that is our sort of quick fire round questions. You smashed that. That was great fun. And hopefully you guys listening along had a bit of fun with that. We've got a comment through from Colin. Great to hear the legendary Paul O'Neill speak in the space. We always look forward to hearing his excellent commentary on the BTCC.
Cheers, Colin.
Have you paid him a fiver?
£10, mate. Inflation and it's the crisis of living in.
Absolutely. Okay, my friend, we're going to now look at your diabetes journey when you were diagnosed. I assume it's half time in the football, so... I've got your full attention for this 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So here we go. Let's get serious and let's talk about your journey with diabetes. So can you share with us, Paul, like when you were diagnosed, obviously your age again, and the sort of symptoms you were experiencing during this time. And I've done a bit of research and, I saw that you were on a family holiday and your sister, who is Mel C, by the way, folks, noticed your symptoms. So please share with us.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's quite an interesting one, to be fair. So we were on a family holiday in Mauritius, which was absolutely stunning. And we were very fortunate to go to these places because of my sister. And I, before I went there, it was December 2003, I think it was. And before I went there, I wasn't feeling brilliant. I'll be dead honest. I was very thirsty and... Well, not very. No, I was just thirsty and I was passing water a bit more than I usually would. And just felt a bit not very nice. Didn't feel very great. So I got over that, and the first week I couldn't even bear to be in the sun, and I'm quite a big sunbather, to be fair, if I get the chance. So I was feeling a bit rubbish, and then as the week went on, when I was over there, I was like, I'm not in good health here. And I was speaking to Armel, and I said, listen, I feel this, this, and this. And she was like, that does not sound good. You need to get checked when you get back home. And long story short, I was, the week I come home, I was then into like drinking probably 6 liters of Tango and stuff like that. Full on sugar, you know, specification drinks.
Yeah.
Passing water like you wouldn't believe.
Just repeating that cycle, right? Drink, like, exactly. Toilet, drink, toilet.
Yeah.
Constantly.
It was horrible. Like, it was horrible. And I then, the last thing I got, I went on a, unfortunately, one of my friends when we were younger, he committed suicide, and we were at a funeral for him. And we all obviously, you know, as you do at funerals and traumatic things like that, we all got right on the drink. And I was 24 by then. And we all started drinking. And the next day I had blurred vision, couldn't hardly like make things out properly. I thought, this isn't good. I don't know what's going on here. So my sister was like, those symptoms now have got to be type 1 pulse. She was like, you've got to get the doctors. So, because she had someone.
And how did you feel when she said that to you? Like, were you like, oh my God, no. Like, what was going through your head?
What was going through my head? Do you want me to be, I'm going to be dead honest now, because no one's really ever asked me that. But because I'd had quite a dodgy time at the end of that year, the racing was fantastic. It was one of my finest years. I was battling for top three in the British Touring Car Championship with my teammates, and it was a great year. I'd had a really depressing end to the year. I'd had a bit of a split with my girlfriend at the time. I was feeling a bit rubbish, as a lot of people do at certain times of the year. And it all got a bit on top of me, to be honest. And I felt a bit numb. If I'm perfectly honest, I felt dead numb. I didn't feel anything. And she just said to me, listen, someone who I work with is type 1 diabetic, and I think he's got the same kind of symptoms as you. Let me speak to him. She spoke to him, and he was like, you've got to get him to the doctor. So I was in the doctor's in the next 2 days. And that's when the nurse practitioner at the time, Dr. Botham, who he is now, who I see quite a lot, he was the guy who he went, that's just red flags for diabetes, mate. That's pretty thing. And it was like 29.6. It was something horrific. And he went, right, we need to get you an ambulance or get you to Whiston Hospital. And that's what happened. And my mum and dad took me there. And I just remember being sat in the passenger seat of my mum and dad's car, just crying my eyes out, because I just knew that was me finished in racing. It kind of like, I'd been numb, and then it all come to light that it was all over.
The reality.
Yeah, exactly. The reality hit me. I knew what was coming, because I'd known about diabetics in racing previous. I was dead lucky with the red tape, because there was a time when you wasn't allowed to race again. It was like HGV drivers back in the day. Mm-hmm. They were took off the road, game over. And I thought it was the end for me. So yeah, that was it. And then I was in hospital for 4 days, just getting used to it. So it's a traumatic time, you know. And I try to put a dampener on it when I speak to a lot of people, because it's the last thing they want to hear when they're newly, you know, new diabetics. You try to be as positive as you can be. But yeah, I'm just telling you the truth. That's how it was. But there's a way around it.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and we appreciate your honesty and openness to feel comfortable to tell us these things. So it's good, and I think it's raising that awareness for people, and they can take it face value, and hopefully it will help them. Mm-hmm.
Got a quick question for you. Did you say it was Mel who picked out your symptoms?
So I told her the symptoms, and she was straight onto it, going, right, well, I know this guy. He works in my office for management of the girls' band, and she was like, "This isn't good." And then
I was actually just going to ask that. I was going to ask, like, does she have any experience with diabetes or anything? Like, how did she know to sort of say, "Oh, hold on, that sounds like diabetes"?
It was exactly that. It was just the fact that she was really close to a lad who was a bit younger than me at her 19 management office. It was, and she always like Darmel's a real decent person, and she always, you know, always tried to help people out, and he struggled a bit with it. I remember her telling me when I first got diagnosed, and it was only because she knew what he'd gone through 6 months before, or maybe 7 months before, and it was
that's actually not that long of a time.
Not at all, exactly. Yeah. So,
as in, say before that, before she recognised it in you.
Yeah, exactly. But she's a clever woman, and she just switched on and aware of other people's, you know, stuff going on.
And that's why it's so important, isn't it, for everyone? And that's why we do these things, I guess, as well, is raising that awareness of the symptoms of diabetes. And you hear the four T's are the common ones, but also there are others like thrust and blurred vision and all sorts. But it's so important to know these things. And then as soon as you, like, in doubt and things aren't quite right, yeah, go check it out, because you know what I mean? I think people appreciate going to the doctors or checking the blood, said, oh, that's fine, and it might be something else, rather than not going and not knowing and then really getting poorly and potentially going into a coma or whatever. So, you know what I mean? Raising that awareness for the symptoms is so important, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly that. And, you know, there's so much... there's a lot more awareness of it now, and I know that over the 24 years, 23 years I've had it, there's a lot more awareness. But, you know, all my very close friends know the sketch with it. Sometimes I don't know about you guys, but you don't want to load people up and make them feel uncomfortable. Because I wouldn't, you know what? If someone said to me, I'm type 1 diabetic, and you didn't really know them that well, and you were on top of a Ben Nevis, or you were walking up Ben Nevis for a bit of a hike with someone you knew, but you were a bit unconfident about telling them about diabetes, you can make you feel a bit like, and now I'm now in charge of this person who could a disaster. You know what I mean? It's only like,
good job you're in a room pretty much full of diabetics. You pretty much can't get uncomfortable in here.
Yeah, no,
people that understand it, you know what I mean? We get amazing people from all over the world who listen, join us week in, week out, or listen back to the podcast. And we've had family members, colleagues, you know what I mean? And people understand what we go through. Mm. Let's have a look. Did you know as a family anything about diabetes before you were obviously diagnosed? Like, did you know anything about it, or your family? Did you have any history of diabetes in the family, or was this all just completely new and just wow?
Mm. So it was medically, it was completely brand new to me, and I knew as much as the next person. But historically and family-wise, I knew that my dad's mum, so my nana, had died of it. Mm. She died of the complications of type 1, but I didn't ever meet her. She died when my dad was pretty young. So, like, my dad tells me of, you know, having to measure potatoes for carbohydrates and, you know, needles that were the size of a barrel, and having to do, you know, and finding his mum lying on the floor in the kitchen, you know, passed out. And the only thing I'd ever seen that I knew about diabetes was a girl, forget her second name, she'll have changed now, but it was Jenny somebody. And she was like, I just remember she was like, we were all like 13, 14, and she was absolutely stunning, like a beautiful girl. Everyone fancied her at school, and she had diabetes. And I just remember it was just a name. But I remember once we were at a house party, and she was taking this gigantic needle that made me want to be sick in my mouth. So this would have been like 93, 94. And I remember saying,
exactly. Yeah. Things have changed right now.
I remember thinking, Jesus Christ, I hope I don't run over any nuns and end up with that. Not Jenny. I meant the needle. Do you know what I mean? It's like, but as it was, I ended up getting it myself. But yeah, so I knew a tiny little bit, and
you cursed yourself there, Paul, didn't you?
Exactly, yeah. I'll never say anything like that again. But to answer your question, I did know tiny amount from
that
bit. My dad's type 2 diabetic, my uncle's my brother is diabetic now, so he's type 2, so we chat. I mean, yeah, and anyone I come across, I get a lot of people asking me about it to do with racing, and you know, youngsters are the ones I try to look after. The dads and the mums will come up to me, you know, this lad or girl won't, you know, they don't want to use a Libra freestyle. They don't want to feel disabled because the, you know, people might laugh at them at school, and then they'll see me up on stage just doing some stupid interview for BMW or something, and it's like the dad rings me and he's like, oh my god. He's like, where exactly. are you now? It's just done. You're doing. I've done nothing, but if that helps you, then that's good.
You're being yourself, but it inspires other people in so many ways. Yeah, and
very fortunate.
You know what I mean, yeah.
I think not being afraid of wearing stuff like that in public is a good thing in general. I mean, obviously you're not, Paul. I'm not, but there's still people that, you know, don't want to necessarily inject. There was a newspaper article recently that was being shared on Twitter about someone who was shocked because they saw someone on public transport injecting. I'm just like, really?
That's amazing, isn't it? Do you know, I'm just, you see where I'm from, I'm pretty thick skinned with, like, my mates are just, they're just horrible, like, and I love that. They take the absolute mick every day of the week, and I love that because
good banter.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? It's just like, that's how it is.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
So, absolutely.
So I know the score, but at the same time, what you got to remember is some people aren't as confident as maybe some of us in this chat room, and like it might get on top. I've never had a problem with it. I couldn't care less if I did it in front of someone who hated needles. Sorry, mate, but that's not my problem. Don't look, then. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
But if I can go somewhere and do it out the way, I will. But my job with racing sometimes, and also, you know, being on a live TV set, there's like 20 people around and I just got to do it. And that's the way it is. But
yeah.
It's like anything in the world at the minute. It's, if something offends you, then just educate the person. It's not a problem. It's cool, man. Let's crack on.
I love that. Really do. So let's talk a little bit before we head over to Gary about the journey that you're on and have been on. You obviously mentioned you're on insulin pens, the disposable pens, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Nova Rapid and Trajeo, I think it's called.
Nova Slow, I remember that.
Yeah.
And you are using Libra or Dexcom?
So I'm on a Libra, yeah. I've only had it about 4 years.
And how's that been for you? Like, if you said you've been diabetic 24 years, looking at the sort of like last 5-10 years of how tech has gone, but like how has being on technology like Libra like helped your life, and how would have helped you back in 2004 when you were racing? Like it would have like been wow, you know.
I tell you what, the last 4 years, I feel like I've been in some kind of accelerator. It's been an absolute life changer, the Libra, and it's been just the biggest educator I have ever had. I cannot get my breath what I see on a graph between me scanning and me not scanning, because when you finger prick, you can be 5.4 and think, oh, I'm absolutely fine. But you don't realize it's come down from 10 and she's skyrocketing. Like, you know, she's heading for the floor in a big way. And I never knew that. And I've only just started to realize that, you know, I always like felt like I was having phantom hypos when I was going to the grid in a British touring car race, you know, with big sponsors and manufacturers and people plowing money into your racing. And I'm going to the grid and I'm like, I'm having a hypo. And I'm panicking, and it's on live ITV. And you're thinking, this is going to go wrong. But, you know, I never had that information when I was racing.
Exactly.
I was just lucky that I was fit and I controlled it well. But I did have some problems.
Have you ever had a low while you've been in a like a race car, like a confirmed low?
I can tell you now, because I'm not. And I love being honest on these kind of things. I'll tell you, I never said to anyone this happened, but I had a... So if you don't watch racing, basically when you qualify, so you qualify on a Saturday afternoon, and that puts you in position for your grid to start the race the next day. So if you're the fastest, you'll start first on the grid and blah, blah, blah. I'm sure people know that. But to do that, to be the fastest out there, the fastest you can go, you'll put £3,000 worth of tires on. You will take everything out of the car weight wise. The car will be like a thoroughbred racehorse for that one lap, so you can be the best on that day to put you as high up the grid to have a chance of winning the race. So people put time, effort, money into it. So I went out and warmed the tyres up as you do. You warm the tyres up for one lap, make sure the slick tyre is ready to go. You come in the pits. They change the tyres around so the hottest ones are in the right place and you can get the best lap time, and then they send you out. And I didn't feel great, but when you're in a race car and the noise and the adrenaline and the sweat in your eyes and it's fight or flight, because that's what you're doing, you don't feel a hypo that much. So
no.
I've gone out the pits thinking, I don't feel great because I'm doing 40 miles an hour down the pit lane on the speed limiter. And then you let the speed limiter go, and then it's game face. It's game on. We go for it. Nothing else matters. It's now, this is life or death. That's the way it is in top level sport. So I've gone out, yeah, and I've gone off, and I've gone across the grass. I've done 15, probably about 12 grand's worth of damage to the car. And I've come in and checked my blood, and I've thought, do I keep this to myself? Could get in trouble here. But I told the team, and like the team boss went mental. Like, he said, I don't care if that costs us 10 grand, 20 grand in tyres or whatever. Never, ever drive the car if you don't feel well, because that's one thing he taught me was, don't think you can just go an extra 3 minutes with a hypo. Do you know what I mean? Because that's what caught me out. And I wasn't unconscious. I didn't endanger anyone really, but I cost the team a lot of money, and I learned something that day. So I never did that again. But yeah, I have learned an easy,
a good valuable lesson.
Yeah.
And I think we can all kind of, I'm sure we've all been in situations, not to maybe that level, but like me as a teacher, like I can see my arrows are dropping or just hitting a hypo, and it's like, oh, lunch is in 5-10 minutes. I can, you know what I mean, carry on for, because I have to be here. I have to be part of the team. I have to make sure effort runs. But, and I've learned over time, I have to step back because, you know what I mean, things could escalate. But honestly, thank you for sharing that. And I guess that's where, just before we head over to Gary and continue this amazing chat with your career, is I guess that's why technology is just like, just been so amazing. And had you had the technology back in that situation or in then times, you would have had the alerts, you would have saw the arrows, you or your team would have made decisions sooner. Because how many times as well, Paul, like you might feel like you're low or whatever, but you're not. It's just how your body's feeling, or you feel high and then you check and you're 7 and you're going, what's going on here? You know what I mean? So, you know, and especially in that situation where you are fully in the zone, you're fully focused, the adrenaline's pumping.
Not too sure if you guys are still there.
Sorry, we seem to have lost Tom. I didn't know if that was my internet or not.
Oh, well, that got rid of him, didn't it? I won't mention anything like that again then. That sounds like he's tipped him over the edge.
Yeah, it should be right.
Look, we can just ditch Tom and we'll move on and make it a bit more.
He's still live streaming, so he's definitely there. Must be a problem with his mic or something, because I can still see him online.
He could have potentially been chipped off from spaces, and because I'm co-host, it's let us remain in the space.
Yeah, you only get a minute, I think.
Well, Tom better hurry up and come back.
Well,
maybe he can.
He's actually gone offline.
Has he? He's had enough of my whinging. Well, yeah, just to,
I'll bring on the Chinese.
I was going to just answer his question just quickly. Just so everyone in the room is aware, like, I think he's back. Is he back?
We can. What happened?
I honestly don't know what happened. I was talking and it just went crazy. So
I think it was your internet, because I tried to connect to you remotely for remote support and even that wouldn't load.
Honestly don't know. I'm on my phone now. Technology, right? Did you get any of that question I put over to you, Paul?
I got the last bit of you were just mentioning, would it have been a bit easier with a labour on the back of your arm?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and yeah, to answer that, definitely. Because one thing it has taught me, and I don't know if anyone has this, if they have got a Libra, is that
when I think I'm having a hypo, I cannot. I'm like, I'm definitely having a hypo, and I check it, and it's not a hypo. It's just the speed at which my sugar levels come down from, say, 7 to 5. You know, the drop off just makes you feel like you're having a hypo, and it's just the trajectory of your blood sugar dropping that fast that can make you feel like you're having a hypo, and you're not, from what your blood sugars are telling you. So yeah, I know now what I was feeling in the car years ago when it felt like it was a hypo and it actually wasn't. So yeah, it would have made my life a lot easier. But at the same time, I always prize myself on not having any regrets in life, and that's just the way it is. And you know, you dealt the card,
of course you do.
And that's it.
Absolutely. So what we'll do is we'll head over to Gary, and he's going to go into more detail about your career. Over to you, Gary.
Thanks, Tom. So I'm just going to look into like career and ask some questions about it, and it will be pre-diabetic, post-diabetic for people to get an understanding. So I think the first thing I want to start off with is, I am assuming that your sister's an integral part of your life, obviously, for like support and things like that, because I don't know if anybody in the chat room is aware of this, but Mel C is like an advocate for Diabetes UK, I believe it is. So I'm assuming that you have a close connection with your sister for this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Gary, that my sister's connection with Diabetes UK is because I was an ambassador for them. And there's a lovely guy that works there. He's a Scottish fella, John Mackay, I think his name is. And he looks after the ambassadors and the people to do with the charity, as in the spokespeople and that. And he, lovely guy. And he asked me, he was like, would your sister be, could she spread the word for us? Like, not an ambassador thing, but help us out. And I was like, I'll ask her. I'm sure it'd be fine. And she's really took it on board, just because it is a thing that's probably was started off by the friend that she worked with, who had it. And then obviously when Muggins got it here. So she's been brilliant for them, because she obviously has a million followers compared to my 500 or whatever it is. So she's been brilliant and knows a lot about it as well.
And that's a great thing. So what we'll start with is just your career and where it all began. So what we'll talk about is like your motorsports journey, like how it all started pre-diabetic, and like the achievements you had in it and things, and any moments you were proud of it in your motorsports career. Now, I'm going to be open and honest with everybody here. I don't know anything about cars, and so if you go into technical stuff or about racing, I'm not going to understand what you're saying, so hopefully people know what you're saying so that they can at least get an understanding.
Neither do I, Gary. What are you trying to say, lad? No. To be fair, I was very fortunate. So, cut a long story short, motorsport is a very expensive sport to get involved with. So when my sister got famous with the Spice Girls and everything in 1995, we were a very modest family in a three bed terrace, and you know, had everything that we could have wished for, to be fair, in a place called Widnes, where I still live. And when my sister got famous, she wanted to do everything that she could for the family and make us have a better life. I was having a bit of not a good time in sixth form college when I was 16, 17. And, you know, my sister was off out traveling the world and doing amazing things and just being like the best person that she could be for the whole family by just making us all so proud. But she was probably that distanced away from it. She didn't realize what she was leaving at home with the rest of the family. We're getting a bit of grief, and not just me. I mean, my dad, my mum would have got a bit of grief as well through, you know, my mum and dad are in a band. So they were singing around the town still. And my dad was working on taxis and my mum was with the NHS, but people started to question why they were probably still working when people thought they didn't have to, which was wrong, because everyone's got a right to work, and we didn't have as much money as everyone thought we did, and it's my sister's money and not ours. And my sister could tell I was on a bad time, so especially at sixth form college, I was getting a bit of bullying. I'm quite happy to admit that. I was getting a bit of grief off people, as thick-skinned as I am. There's only so much people can take, and everyone's got a point where they just think, this is not good. So I remember I had a bit of a breaking point with someone, and I left college and I got myself a proper job building amplifiers in Warrington. And then I had a really terrible time and crashed a car in Warrington. And that got on the front page of the Red Tops. And that caused me a lot of grief around where I live, but just constant, you know, bullying and being horrible. So in the end, Armel was like, you need to come out to the World Tour and make sure that you are, you know, you're all right. People are worried about you. You're having a bad time. So single-handedly, my sister said to me, whatever you need to do, whatever you want to do, find out how you do it, and I will help you with anything you want. And I was like, I'd love to raise touring cars. I've watched them on the television, on Grandstand, BBC One, as it was then. She went, well, you know what you need to do? Find out what the score is. So I went off on my own to find out how I tried to do it, met some amazing people along the way, and got into racing. And because I didn't really want to, I suppose, live in a shadow for the rest of my life, it was the only thing I needed to focus on, get fit and make sure I was the best I could be. And I was effing dreadful, I'll be honest. When I first started, I was like getting lapped, which means all of the racing people you're racing against overtake you on the circuit. Everyone overtakes you. You're the worst person ever. I was crashing. I was just everything that you didn't want to be. So I was a laughing stock, really. And it took me till I nearly give up in the first year. And then I was glad I didn't, actually, because I got picked up by a team who really believed in me. And the second year was just monumental. I had my first ever podium. And then the third year I was racing in British touring cars. And I don't think there's been many people who've raced at top level in their third year of racing anything, because people usually start at 4 or 5 years of age, like Lewis Hamilton and Jenson Button and people like that. So yeah, I went on a massive trajectory, and by year three and four of racing cars, I was winning on live television and living my best life. And that's when it all ended. It ended as soon as it started, because 2003 was my last season. When I got diabetes, I stopped, and then obviously, like we said before, people didn't know I had a big gap between coming back to racing. So yeah, I did 99, 2000, 2001, 2002, and then after 2003, I was sidelined. So yeah, it's been a bit of a disjointed kind of career, but I'm still at it, and I'd like to think I'm probably a lot more experienced and aware of what I do and what, you know, what diabetes is about. And the best thing for me is that I can hopefully help other people who are not as experienced as me with diabetes, who are racing or just life in general, and I can accelerate their learning quicker so they don't have to deal with maybe the rubbish that us lot in here have had to deal with on the way up the ladder. So yeah, very lucky, very privileged, and it's been an honour to do what I've done so far. So yeah, I'm happy as Larry.
Well, I think it's great that you've highlighted, and I think there was some key points there that you've highlighted, like the experiences you've had. Like, being the best way to describe it is what you've just said, is the first year and like being potentially what you thought was the worst motorsports person that you could potentially have been, but then showing that it's just about putting commitment and driving and focusing on something and being hyper focused on it. And I think you also highlighted, I don't know if anybody in the community can relate to it, but I'm talking from a slightly different perspective here. I feel like being diabetic put me in the background because I could watch my sibling do things that I was looking at and thinking, well, I'm never going to be able to do this because I've got this big, huge burden that's attached to me. And because at the point when I was diagnosed, it was a kind of, I was in that, see, like that girl you were talking about with the big barrel needles. I was the big barrel needle guy, so, and you had to count. I was still told you had to count how many potatoes you could eat at that point, and like you were basically taking insulin and feeding insulin with food, so there was no option. You had to eat what you were told to eat, and that, like that. And I think you also highlighted as well, so like, as I was saying, highlighting that you felt like because your sister was in this trajectory herself of becoming this, and let's not lie, this huge influence in worldwide in music industry, you feel like, you sometimes feel like you're in the background because somebody's doing something, and you've just highlighted that it just takes hard work and commitment, focusing something, which is a great thing. I think even people that aren't diabetic or people that are in a point of their life where they're struggling, that's something that will be great for them to hear, because this isn't just about... So we get a lot of people in that are non-diabetic, and then we got a lot of healthcare professionals, so it's letting them hear that even before your diagnosis, you still had this, still had problems that you could work through. So I think like the first bit we've completely smashed, because I think you basically answered everything that we were looking for, and can I get people to know about your story. So this is the fun bit. So we're getting into where you were diagnosed with diabetes and living with diabetes in your career. And I know that you were like, you managed your championship in 2003, and you went, I believe you placed fourth in that, and then you took that extended, we'll call it a career gap. But what I think I would like to ask is, over that career gap, you did speak a lot about kind of focusing on yourself and getting yourself fit and healthy so that you could get back into it. Was that based on, like, because you were so passionate about it, or was it a bit of resent there because you were regretful that you had, and I think regretful is the wrong word, you were angry that you had managed to be diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and you felt like it was going to be a hindrance? So was it more of a focus of like showing yourself that you could do it, or was it just so much passion that you just didn't want to leave the career?
Do you know, Gary, it's a good question, mate. I'll be honest, that it never once crossed my mind that I would not get back to racing at that top level. I don't think it did.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only time it crossed my mind is when I was sat in the passenger seat of my mum and dad's car, crying me out, thinking that's it, game over. Once I got out the hospital and got on my mountain bike and went and got fit as I could, I knew I was back in the game. And I think that the only thing I don't think I've ever had to prove anything to myself, because I've never believed in myself that much, and that's probably why I was never a champion. The one thing I will say is nothing else mattered to me. Like, literally, family, forget family, they matter. They're there, that's them. Nothing else mattered to me except for just racing cars. That's the only thing that's never really let me down in life. It's a love affair I've had since I can remember being 5 years of age, but it's never let me down. It didn't give me diabetes. It's given me amazing life lessons. It's given me an amazing career. But I just felt that it was the only thing that made sense, and I was massively fortunate that my sister was able to help me get into it and now give me a career that gives me an amazing life. So I had no regrets about diabetes, and I had no resentment with you know, not being able to do the sport, because I knew it had come to me if I wanted it bad enough. So yeah, it is it. But I'll tell you what, mate, I think back and I just think it, I think diabetes fell at the right time for me, because the one thing I cannot get my breath about is teenagers getting it, or kids in single figures, like 8-9-year-olds. I mean, that is just drastic. That's drastic because I'd done my drinking. I'd done my larging about, giving it the big one when I'd been like 18, 19 years of age. And I felt like I'd just had a bit of a reset and I just needed to go again and do what, that's what I felt. And it was a massive, it's the biggest life lesson I've ever had. And I've had some life lessons with my job and with things I've had to do. So yeah, it was huge for me, mate.
Mm-hmm. And I think that you've just highlighted this big bit. I think it is like getting it at a later stage of life, as much as it's still traumatic and it's challenging, you sometimes don't feel like you missed out as much as what you could have, because, I mean, I'm not going to lie, I have had diabetes since I was born, basically. So it was a couple of months after I was born, they identified that I was diabetic. But everybody assumes I missed out a whole chunk of my life. I mean, I went through that teenage stage where you'd go and get drunk and forget you were diabetic and never took care of yourself. But it was the aftermath. So now I'm living with issues that if I took better care of myself, I wouldn't be in this position. And I think it's great to hear you acknowledge that, you know, how difficult it must be for single figures or teenagers, because they're going through already what is a bumpy stage in life, and then if fling in something so complex and challenging just makes it a little bit more difficult for them. Now, we know you took a 2-year break because of diabetes, and we also know that you had your license revoked. What sort of process did you have to go down? Because I know that I've had my license revoked, and I know the complexities I get round about it. So obviously we had a different dimension for motorsports racing and things. What sort of things did you have to go through and make sure that you could get your license back and you were allowed to pursue that career that you'd been that used to doing?
Well, I think first of all, like you say, it affects people differently, doesn't it? And I think we can all, if we're diabetic in this group, I think we can all put our hands up and say we could have looked after ourselves better.
I think we can all do that, yeah.
We can all do that, but to different extents. You know, I think that sport kept me a bit more focused, because if I didn't have sport, I think it depends what mental mindset you are at the time. I think, you know, I've had bad times like probably anybody in this room, and if it had got me then, I might not even be here to tell you the story. Do you know what I mean? So, and that's not a suicidal thing. That's just a bad diabetic management. I could have gone into a coma and died, or, you know, like some poor people have. So there's all sorts of different things. You can't, you know, like I'm sure everyone will agree, it's not just diabetes that will do that. It's everything else that goes with it.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, sorry, MSA, Motorsport Association, I'll tell you the truth. It wasn't actually me that. Obviously, it was me because I wanted to go back racing. But to get the ball rolling, I think my mum must have chopped down about 60,000 square acres of Amazon rainforest with faxes back into the MSA and emails, because she was just on the case of these people at the Motorsport Association saying what needs to be done, can it be brought forward? He's got HbA1c of 5.2, I think it was back in the day. You know, it's pretty amazing. But they were like, nah, sorry, it's got to be this 6 month. It's got to be this 6 month time. And then you're going to have to book in and see the doctor from the MSA, who weirdly was like the most obese, diabetic looking man you've ever seen. And this guy's telling me how to live my life when, you know, I'm a pretty like decent sports person who could run a marathon or, you know what I mean? And then kind of things you have to kind of put to the side and take the medical, you know, advice that you can't race and you cannot get a license for 6 months, and that hurts, but you just always have to see light at the end of the tunnel. And that's a general thing in life. Do you know what I mean? That's a general thing that I live by, is that you go until you can't get up again, and that is it. You get on with it. You just do your best. You keep going. You push on. You go again. No problem. And that's a mentality that I think my mum and dad and my sister have got. Maybe not my dad, to be fair, too much. Joking. He'd rather sit there with a whiskey. But do you see what I mean? It's like I knew that there was no other way. It just needed to be done and crack on with it. And luckily, my mum is of the same mindset, and she was very instrumental in getting me back racing, and actually getting my sister in probably the Spice Girls with a few of the things she did. So I knew she had good form for a phone conversation with some very great people.
And do you know, I'm just going to take from that, like, what you've said is the best thing about that is mums, you couldn't live without them. They will push and push and push, and they're like a they're like a dog with a bone. If they want something, they're going to push you to take it. And it sounds like your mum was really pushing for you to get back in sooner, which is a great thing because it just shows that your mum had all that. Even though you says earlier, you didn't feel like you had a lot of confidence in yourself, it shows you your mum and your sister had, and your dad and everybody had all this confidence in you, knowing that you could do this. And that's a great bit to hear from it, is like just how much advocacy even just your family are giving for you to tell you, knowing that you know you can do this. And I think that's amazing, can I, looking at it that way, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Listen, I'm not saying it for effect. Anyone who's got, you know, parents, you know, will always fight your corner, I'm sure. But the thing for me was, I think because all of my family are, you know, my sister's a singer, my mum's a singer, my dad's bass guitarist. They've all, say, competed at the top level. So, mm-hmm. you know, they know what it is like to have your passion fenced off. Mm-hmm. So that's why they keep going. And you know, the day you give up on your passion, I think it's a sad day, and you that's when you know it's over. So yeah. You know, you can't force your passion. So the only thing you can do is if it gets stopped in its tracks, then you find a way through the barrier or whatever. And that's something that, you know, family is very important to me, and that's what they show me, and that's what I did. And that's probably why I got good results for someone who's not really on paper should be up there, you know. So you do what you can, and it's a very important thing. And it's not just family, it's friends. I'm very lucky. Yeah. I've had friends from school, and I'm sure, like you guys all know, you've got to have the right people around you and be very grateful if you have as well.
Yeah, definitely. So another couple of things, and then I'll pass you on to Kez, who's going to go through another couple of wee bits with you, and then I promise we're nearly done. So obviously doing motorsports and that, was there things that you had to change in days that you were racing and days you weren't? So like, did carb ratios have to change? Did you try and run your blood sugars a wee bit higher in the days, or did you still try and keep them in a really tight control, is the best way to describe it? Or were you a wee bit more relaxed so that you reduced the risk of hypos?
God, you've done this before, haven't you? You know the score. Yeah, of course. I mean, again, I've never really spoken about this, but because it's quite personal, and you don't want people to think that you let yourself go because, you know, it was a free holiday to keep you, you know, put your levels high, but you're dead right. So a British Touring Car race weekend, you're there Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You are very intensely competing on a Saturday for a short amount of time, mm-hmm. for qualifying and free practice. So 2 40-minute sessions. So it'd be like going to the gym at a high intensity twice for 40 minutes, an hour and a half between each other. Mm-hmm. Then you'd go into qualifying for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, and that's intense. Then you get terrible sleep on the Saturday night, and you have three races, which are 25 minutes long each. And that is where you feel the strain. Your body mm-hmm. starts to get exhausted. The heat in the car, I had a temperature gauge on my crash helmet once just to see what the score was. It was summer's day. It was about 32 degrees, 33 degrees at Snetterton in Norfolk. And I think I pushed 58 degrees or 54 degrees centigrade in the car.
Heat for diabetics suck in general.
Horrific. Like the worst situation, that is. So I knew that the day before leading up to the weekend for racing, it was carbs a lot more, and it was half the insulin,
mm-hmm.
and it was loads of water, because the dehydration, you lose 3 or 4 kilos. You've heard of drivers losing 3 or 4 kilos in a race before. On a very hot day, that's what you'd lose in a touring car race or the three races. The problem I had, though, it wasn't anything like that. It wasn't the driving, it wasn't the heat, it was the between race 2 and 3, the second and third race of the day, you had a pit lane walkabout, which meant they opened the pit lane and the 40,000 people who were there come and get your autograph, and they're allowed to go in the pit lane. So you have all that going on, and you're eating your dinner on the hop or your lunch, sorry. You're eating your lunch on the hop. But I was given a bit of a dispensation because you get fined if you don't turn up for the autograph session. And I used to be about 5 or 10 minutes late because you're literally out the car into an engineering meeting to say, how do we make the car better for the next race? Then you sat in the sun signing autographs and feeling like death. But I kind of was given a bit of a get out of jail free card on that one, but still people frowned upon it because they were like, they didn't understand diabetes and they thought I was being rude. Not everyone. My fans, when I raced, were just blimmin' amazing, like the best people ever. But you could see some people were annoyed because they'd been stood in the queue for, you know, 20 minutes to get in or whatever. And they were like, why is this lad turning up late? And I didn't mean it to be rude because not everyone knows I'm diabetic and not everyone knows any of you guys are diabetic either. So, yeah. Difficult one.
I can't believe you said 58 in the car. I'm dying when it gets to like 28.
It's the, you know, it's really bad. It's the, it's because you've got 3-layer Nomex on and the cars are black inside usually. So it, the heat just gets in the car and it doesn't leave and you can't have the window.
Well, and no aircon because that would add weight.
Yeah, no aircon. You have all the vents blocked off for aero and you can't open the windows because it's illegal to have the windows open in a saloon. Race car and British touring cars it is, so yeah, that's all disabled.
An interesting fact I didn't know.
Yeah it's I tell you what, I'd have to go to the I'd probably have to have a word with the governing body if I was to race a British touring car again, which I quite easily could if I wanted to, because you're not allowed to carry an auxiliary water bottle in the car now, where I used to have a Camel pack with Lucozade in it, and it was on a one-way return valve.
What?
That I stuffed in my mouth, yeah. So I actually might see if I can do a British touring car race just to make a few people scratch their heads. Obviously, I wouldn't do that. I'm only joking. But yeah, you're not allowed them. There's a few things now. It's, yeah, it's interesting times in racing.
Well, basically, you've just answered my next question, so I don't even need to ask it because it was like, how did you treat things in the car, like did you keep hypo treatments and that in? But clearly you kept Lucozade in. So what I am going to do is pass you over to Kez. She's just going to go through some mental health and like kind of peer support discussion with you and learn a little bit about your pundits and other career roles. So Kez, that is us ready to move over.
So, yeah, I'm not going to take up too much of your time because it's been quite interesting hearing what you've had to say so far.
And it's 2-0 Liverpool. It's 2-0 Liverpool, Paul.
Yeah, I did. I thought it was going to get ruled offside, but it didn't. Sorry, Kez.
Oh, what?
Sorry about
that. No, sorry, Kez.
Lads being lads. It's all good.
Bit of lads banter on the diabetes chat, right?
Oh, no. It's fine. So, yeah, the section that I do is really around mental health, peer support and advocacy. So I guess the first thing I'd want to know is, do you feel that having a diagnosis like you did as an adult had any impact on your mental health at all?
I'd be probably lying, Kez, if I said no. I think anything that changes the way you live and how you think has an impact on your life, doesn't it? So I think to answer your question, yes, it did. Did I ever think that I was different than anybody else? Definitely not. Did I live like I was different to anyone else? Definitely not. There's not many things that I can't do. I can't think of anything that I just strictly cannot do with having to carry an over-rapid pen round. Don't get me wrong, things get tough. I did a charity bike ride with, I think, 15 or 16 of my friends for the local hospice up the road. And it was London to Paris, and it was 364 miles in 4 days. So it was like 80, 90 miles a day. And I'm no longer an athlete. I'm a 15 stone plus fella. I'm a 43-year-old man. So I had to be pretty fit for it. Did I keep the hypos to myself when I was 60 miles in, going up the worst hill in the world in northern France? Yes, I did, because I didn't want to upset anyone else that was on the ride because I was leading it. So yeah, that kind of stuff
is always in the back of your mind. So you do sometimes change how you think, but it's not how you're going to deal with the hypo. It's how other people are going to deal with your situation, like I mentioned before. So yeah, I think it does. I think I'd be lying if I said that it's an easy thing. It really isn't, but you deal with it as best you can. And yeah, it is. It's different for different people. I mean, it might be easier for other people than it is for me, but I know it's easier for me than it is for a lot of other people as well. So it's just getting into your head what's best for you and how to guide yourself through it and help people out along the way if you can as well. I've always believed in passing it on. If you can pass something on, just try and do that.
Yeah, definitely. Which actually leads into the next thing I was going to ask. Like, what support do you think has been most beneficial to you? And kind of following on from that, what would you recommend other people to like try and get involved in if they're struggling a bit at the moment?
Do you want me to be dead honest with you?
Yeah.
I would say I learned a lot in lockdown, actually. and that's where the biking come from for the charity. And I always say to people, you know, it doesn't matter how unfit you are or, you know, fit you are. And if you can do it, it's the best thing I've ever done is get on a bike. Get on a bike and get outside. If you ride a mile, if you ride 10, if you ride 50, if you ride 120, like I've done once before, it's the best thing for you. And if you can't do that, just do some kind of fitness. Walking, one of the best things you can ever do. Go and walk somewhere. I know you might not want to do it, but it's the best thing ever. I think that would be the best thing for me to be honestly saying is a good thing to do.
Yeah, definitely. I get that. I mean, mine was swimming. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I do get it. It does make a difference.
Mm.
In terms of the peer support and advocacy, we've kind of seen that you're an ambassador with Diabetes UK, and also there's a mention of Sporting Memories Foundation. Did you want to share a little bit about your involvement with those things?
Yeah, sorry. What was the first one you said?
It says Diabetes UK.
Yeah, so for me, the Diabetes UK things come about with I think because I was quite high profile in racing, they must have seen me speaking quite a bit about things. So I've done quite a few talks for them, but I've not done anything of late, to be honest. But I still keep in contact with them, and I do more social media things for them now, like sharing posts and tweets and just trying to stay involved with what's going on. And they share things with me that are embargoed, so I see stuff that is amazing in the news as that's going to be released about diabetics. So we kind of help each other. I then went on to JDRF, which is Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. I did some stuff with them as well, same kind of stuff as Diabetes UK, which was lovely, and because I loved helping the youngsters out. Quick one about that. 2006, my first proper touring car weekend back for the first time I got in a touring car since I was diabetic, and JDRF brought 10 teenagers with their parents to watch the race, right? And they all thought I was the most uncoolest person they'd ever met. None of them would speak to me, but I didn't realize they're just teenagers, aren't they? They ate like people like who were 30 or 26 or 7, whatever it was. You're just a bit of an uncle knobhead, aren't you, to be fair? So they stay away from you. When I got on the, what happened that I led the race, and it was a live ITV one round, so it was on the main channel. So I was a diabetic driving in a car that was I was the first person in the UK or in the world, I think, to lead a race in a bioethanol fueled car, which, if you don't know what that is, that's a car that was fueled by sugar beet. Get on that.
And sometimes freeze in the winter.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a bit of a story. When I got out of the car, I finished fifth, I think, or something, which was an amazing result for the little team I was doing it for.
everyone was cheering. It was like they won the championship. Like, it was a big event. There was a lot of people at Silverstone that day. And all these kids, they couldn't wait to speak to me. And I got so many amazing emails and things from the parents. It was just stunning. And you know, when you're like, I didn't even need to do anything. I was just doing my thing. And if anyone can take something from that, I think that is amazing. So the JDRF thing was great. And it's a shame I don't do more stuff for the youngsters with diabetes. I do what I can, but no one really comes and speaks to me about it from any organisations. So, you know, I try to just help them out journalistically and stuff like that now to do with my job. But I'm all for the youngsters and helping them along. And the Sporting Memories Foundation, just quickly on that, that's a dementia charity that a friend of mine used to co-found. And I did the Great North Run for them twice, which was absolutely awesome. We made some good funding for them. And it's a pretty special place, that is. That's a really, really cool charity. They're still doing good things. And one that I'm a massive advocate for is the Halton Haven Hospice, which is a hospice up the road from me, where my brother was 6 or 7 years ago. So we started fundraising for them. And I think we've done about, I think me and my friends have raised, like, London to Paris, all that kind of stuff. We've done probably about 60, 70 grand, I think, over the last few years. So it's pretty cool. So really privileged to do that as well. So it's just nice you can get on your bike and actually give something back, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. That sounds really good. That's one I haven't heard of before. So, yeah, quite interesting, that one.
Yeah.
Okay, so just finally, before I hand back to Tom then, what do you think your hopes and aspirations are for yourself and for diabetes care and management in general for the future?
I'm probably like everybody. I want to see a lot more. I'll be honest, actually, I want to see a lot more done. I think the awareness is going great places. I'm sick of seeing, I'm not saying charities don't do the best they can, but there seems to be a lot of money being raised and stuff being done. But I just hope in my lifetime I see a really, you know, fantastic breakthrough, holy grail that means people don't have to maybe suffer like people in this room have. Not me.
Yeah,
I'll take myself out of that, because I haven't suffered, to be fair. Not yet. I might do.
And I think as well, Paul, is when I speak to a lot of people on here or in person and stuff who's had diabetes for quite a while, especially like people growing up in, I don't know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, and they say, there's going to be a cure in 5 years. There's going to be a cure in 5 years. That sort of people saying. But right now, you just feel diabetes is in a good place. The momentum of how things are progressing with technology and closed looping coming through. Mm. Like, there's optimism. There's hope, isn't there? There's a good place to be for someone who's got diabetes, which we shouldn't be saying at all, you know what I mean? But it's you feel quite promising about what's to come, hopefully.
Oh, listen, oh Jesus, I'll tell you now, from being on that hospital bed in January in 2004 to where I am now, and I downloaded an app. I had a look at it myself. I was like, I've got to get this Apple Watch working with this Libre. I've just got a Libre 2. I'd only had a 1. And the difference between the 2 and the 1, I'm sure if you don't know, is it's got a Bluetooth connection, so an alarm on it. So if you go low or high. I downloaded this app called Sugar, which is spelt weirdly. I think it's S-H-U-G-G-A-H.
I know exactly what you're talking about, because I work in tech.
Oh, okay. Well, exactly that one. That one. That has gone for me another step change. It's another step change. It's on my phone. It's on my watch now. And it's like, I can tell in the last 2 weeks that I've had it, that it's controlling my sugars a lot better. So if you haven't got it and you've got a Libre 2, I don't know if it works with a Dexcom. You might be able to tell me that. I don't know.
No, but there is one. I think Sugar Meat works on, at least iPhones, that sounds, for Dexcom.
That sounds like a diabetic scouser. Sugar Meat. Is that what it's called?
yeah, that's it. Gives you all sorts of graphs and stuff. I actually figured out I got three unicorns the other day, if you know what they are.
Oh, nice.
We'll give you a quick PSA, though. Don't rely on sugar at the moment if you're using a pump, because it has no sort of safety built in. It literally just does read your sugars constantly.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So I put it on the internet. I put it on my Instagram saying, this is cool. Give us a shout if you want to know any more. I spoke to quite a lot of people, even people who didn't follow me, were messaging me. I told them exactly how it was, and I didn't tell them anything that I didn't know about. Because the problem is it disconnects, doesn't it, from your Libra Bluetooth, so it doesn't alarm you, as in the Libra sensor doesn't alarm you, because the algorithms are different. So your readings are just a little bit different than they are from your actual scanning your arm than what the sugar app tells you. So yeah, it is great, and it does, and it's massively helpful, and you can get alarms on it, but the sounds are rubbish. I mean, they're horrible, the sounds. I mean, I don't know what my friends think when my sounds go off for that. They must think I've got some weird app, a dating app or something. It's weird.
We'll just hear you coming.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's great.
I can see Belinda's jumped on. Hey, Belinda.
Hey. I was just going to make a comment about the wish that we all want. Sorry, it's Belinda from Australia. I'm a diabetes.
Hey, Belinda.
Diabetes educator and researcher. I also have a sibling with type 1. He was diagnosed age 9, now 42. You can do the maths. Also waiting for a cure for quite some time. And that was what I was going to jump on and mention, just about this whole research process. And, yeah, we do all – I get tired as well, and I work in the research field. People just talk, and you feel like, where's the action? But I can 100,000,000% guarantee I do attend a lot of national and international conferences, and there are so many researchers in the space of so many different elements of diabetes working their butt off, working so hard to you know, improve outcomes for people with diabetes, find that cure. There's the Australasian type 1 immunotherapy. I might be able to share it on a tweet website that's just started up, that's really trying to push that immunotherapy science, to try and use immune therapies to reverse the effect of antibodies, so then we can try and stop the diabetes from actually happening. So that's really exciting research. But the challenge is, and this is why we need all this fundraising, is that diabetes research is one of the least funded in the whole world.
Wow.
And this is what we need to talk about. This is what we need to get everyone behind. The money that goes towards most research is all largely cancer related. And sadly, wrongly, that's because it pulls at the heartstrings.
Yeah.
So there's, yeah.
I think
it's
as
challenge.
Well, like following on from what you've just said there as well, Belinda, I think that diabetes is seen as a cash cow still at this moment in time. It's a cash cow for companies because they can gouge out in anything. Like, there was this whole kick up about, and we will probably talk about it later on in the night because, you know, we'll have a good rant, about Dexcom and Nick Jonas and Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Advertising a technology that people are claiming is luxurious and you don't need it, but the people that are claiming it's a luxury don't understand the need for it. And I think that until we get over this whole point of being a cash cow for people and being able to pull money out of diabetes, the funding for it will always be limited, because governments don't want to fund it, farmers don't want to fund it, because they make astronomical profit off a something that they can make for like $6, and they can charge in America $329 a vial. It's until we get by that point and get people to see that we're not there to support them and make money. I think that's where the problem comes in.
This has come up in conversation quite a lot, but it actually goes beyond that. It literally comes down to the statistics, and that's the problem. Government policymakers, what's that other big word, the one that I can't pronounce, philanthropy, all those people that have the money to throw at things, they won't do it unless they've got the statistics. And we need the research to get the statistics, but we need the money to do the research. So it does come across as, yeah, we're not going to throw money at it because then no one's going to make any money out of it. But it's nothing's linear. It's very multilinear. It's very complex.
I think as well, Belinda, I think, you know, we are very, what we forget is we live in an amazing country at the end of the day, and it's all down to percentages about how you live. One, you're very lucky to be born. Massive percentage of that is very lucky to be born.
Absolutely.
You're lucky to be born into an amazing country like you are in Australia.
Yep.
I couldn't imagine having this condition in a third world country, you know, and as much as we have to push on, we've got to realise that we are very fortunate.
Absolutely.
You know, we're very fortunate people. And I'll push on like the next person, like you say. So I fully agree with what you're saying. But like anything in the world, things need to change for the better. There's always room for improvement, isn't there?
Yeah, and certainly, as I said, there are a lot of people working 24/7. Like, I was on my emails after hours last night for research work. I emailed probably half a dozen people regarding other research projects. They all answered me at 9 p.m. We all clock off at 5 p.m. That'll be happening literally all around the world in the research world. So people are working hard. But I also think...
I thank you personally for what
you
did.
Oh, no. This is not a self-pity
comment.
But I think what would be really helpful is, and I've often thought about this, is a session maybe on this platform or at, you know, conferences. But I think it needs to be directed to community is actually how the research process happens, because research is slow and good research is slow. And we don't just want any old research, because it needs to be reliable, accurate, impactful. And there's just so many multi-layers to getting good research happening. And everyone thinks they're an expert, especially since COVID, because you can just jump on Google and do your research. But it's such a complicated process. And I think if we had someone out there who's really not me, I'm junior, but someone out there with a lot of experience of years working in research and understands every layer, talking to community about how you get good research happening from study design to impact, I think it would reassure a lot of people. Anyway, that's my rant.
So, Paul, thank you so much for tonight, for coming on the Diabetes Chat. And there's so many more questions that I put down in the notes, which I'm sure in the future we'll catch up and maybe do another one of these, talking a bit more about your sport pundancy and other things. I know you do you were a co-founder of the 29 Productions, and I know you do mentoring and coaching for people for driving. You have to set me up. We'll have to do a diabetes chat where you show me some motor skill masterclass. That'd be hilarious.
Hey, we have the ability to go live with video now on Twitter.
Oh my God.
We can do that.
Brilliant stuff.
Now, listen,
but honestly,
thanks for having us. It's been a real pleasure. It's just nice to connect with other people who have the same obstacles to jump, and we'll be all good. We crack on.
There we go, folks. We'll all be good. We crack on. We do our best, don't we? That's all we can try. But honestly, it's been a really good chat tonight. It's been great fun, and it's been really engaging, you chatting with the community and getting involved. We've got loads of people commenting on the hashtag and getting involved, and it's just been really great fun. Just finally, where can people maybe check out more about you on your social media, YouTube and stuff, your website? Where can people go find you?
Do you know what's a very good question? I'm a bit rubbish with my own website. So I think
to be honest, I know the answers. I'm just asking the questions.
I think on Instagram and at OWY 29, which is basically my nickname and my race number, OE29, OWY29. And on Twitter, I am on Paul O'Neill 29, I think. So, yeah, I'm around and I'm always mouthing off. So I apologise in advance.
It's been good fun. It's been good fun. Thank you, Paul, for effing and coming along tonight. Gary, Kez, was there anything you wanted to conclude or anything else to ask? Or it's been good, hasn't it?
It's been amazing. I just want to say you have made our job so much easier tonight because you just did a way out. Engaging with the community, speaking with people, and keeping the community just in the loop with things. So I thank you for that because you have saved us copious amounts of time for debates to start because it means we can just start ramming right into them as soon as we come off. So it has been fantastic to get to hear your story and hear about your journey. So thanks very much for that.
Absolutely,
it made a great chat.
Oh, thanks, guys. No dramas at all, anytime.
And Liverpool won, so maybe we need to do this more often and do spaces when Liverpool are on.
Exactly.
So you're saying if we get Paul on, Liverpool's going to win?
Potentially. We're going to win the league, Paul.
Jesus Christ. We'll have to do a lot of these space chats. Jesus Christ.
Hey,
you're
Paul.
Always welcome back anytime.
Here's one for you. Here's one for you, Paul.
Go on.
If it plays.
When you walk through a storm.
There we go.
I'm going to revoke your ability to play sounds, Tom.
And actually, amazing indeed. James, who's on the line, actually mentioned it last week, and Belinda, when we're talking about peer support and having communities like this, there's so many great communities online and in person, and when you look at the lyrics and you'll never walk alone, and you look at that sort of statement, I guess, especially with diabetes, is you'll never walk alone. Like, you've got people who will support you and help you through the good times and the bad times, and that's why I set the diabetes chat up, was to not feel alone and to normalize things and have people who understand and just get it. And yeah, I thought we'd end with that for our diabetes chat with you tonight.
I thought it was absolutely perfect, mate. It was perfect, and you're dead right. You should like anything, it's always good to have a little chat and get you along the way. It's all good.